Hi, this is Ryan Dunn. I'm the technical evangelist for SSDS, SQL Server Data Services, and I'm sitting here today with a couple of the team members. Why don't you guys just go ahead and introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Ishwan Cherry, architect on the SSDS service.
And I'm Nigel Ellis. I'm the development manager for the service.
Great. So what have you guys been working on?
Well, we've been working on in the last 18 months or so on this service, which is a highly available, simple-to-use, scalable internet service. Right now, we started in simple storage, and we'll move it forward as we go.
Moving forward, starting to look at blob storage and other interesting capabilities. So for those of you who didn't see the announcement, we announced our service at Mix in Las Vegas last 2 weeks ago now, and pretty much went on stage. Did a bunch of live demos against the service, which is pretty interesting. We're getting to the point now where we feel like our service is actually reliable enough for people to start using it. There's a bunch of people inside Microsoft using it, and we're just about to open up our service to a closed beta with a bunch of initial customers. And essentially, our sign-up site's gone out. There's obviously been picked up in the blogosphere, and there's been a large number of people signing up. We have several thousand people in the queue for our service right now. And we'll start to take those people off in a prioritized order as we start to open up our service.
That's fantastic. So I'm talking to you guys today about architecture. And I think some of the folks watching this are probably just interested in where do I fit SSDS into my existing apps today and maybe new apps that I'm going to build. So if you guys could maybe talk about some of the scenarios, how you would architect things, or really, what changes when I architect with SSDS? That'd probably be helpful.
Well, one thing I would start with is even though right now SSDS is a very simple, easy-to-use service, it has very powerful technology behind it. It's built based on SQL Server. We'll talk a little bit about it. There are really three layers inside the service. We have a management layer, which takes care of failover, failure detection. We have the SQL Server layer. And we have a mid-tier, which is actually implementing the Sitka front-end. So there is lots of interrelated technologies running here, potentially eventually on thousands of servers. So it's very interesting how it all came together. But overall, we think one of the huge added values, it's very easy to approach it, very easy to provision data, very easy to actually get into the game and storing data. And in time, we'll keep opening up the capabilities and give you more and more of the power of SQL Server, which is driving the whole service.
Well, that's actually really interesting. Why did we choose SQL Server here? I mean, just why not start from scratch or something like that? What was the specific capabilities?
We actually did think about starting from scratch, to be honest. But we went through a design process before we actually started the work. And we looked at existing services inside of Microsoft. There is actually SQL Server is widely used inside Microsoft services already today. It's proven technology. It's an industry standard database engine. And when we actually went through some of the design process, everybody agreed it makes a lot of sense to use proven technology and build the service basically around it.
Yeah, I think one of the things we'd also looked at, so this design process that Isfan mentioned, this was a collaboration between the SQL Server group, the Windows Live team, and also Microsoft Research. And as part of it, there was general acknowledgement that you could build something from scratch, but as we started to look further afield at the capabilities that we felt these applications needed, it would get increasingly more expensive to build those things. So instead, we chose to take an existing set of technologies that we had, modify them to make them more suitable for deployment at scale in these data centers. So we're now talking about essentially reducing our cost in terms of machine costs and operations cost, running on commodity hardware. The hardware is not as reliable as typical hardware, so we have to throw more boxes together. Logically, you can think of gluing these things together. And when one of those boxes fails, we need to make sure that the service still has high availability. So that's where we, as Isfan mentioned, we have our failover capabilities. Understanding that something failed, that server dies, and we actually take its workload and seamlessly transfer it over to another server.
Interesting.
Yeah, we invested during, that was, as Nigel said, one of the main design goals has been always for the services to make sure it's fully automated and we don't have to have human intervention when something goes wrong. We are running on fairly cheap hardware, not too cheap, but fairly cheap hardware to make sure we can scale and we can and we use redundancy to make sure the data will always be available. But one of our main design goals has been and still is to make sure that the service just works automatically without human intervention.
That's great. So as an architect, where do I fit SSDS into my apps today? Or where do you see SSDS fitting into some of the capabilities that I want to build or new types of applications that I want to build?
The main thing I would mention here right now is the fact that the service is always available, always there for you. It makes very interesting scenarios where you can put your data there, it's always available, it's a mobile device or your laptop or your desktop. Or even if you're writing a three-tier app, mm-hmm. this is data you can put into the sky, into the cloud, and it's always available. You can query it. It's all indexed. So there are very interesting scenarios where you put data there which has to be always available. And then eventually we'll open it up, as I said, and we can do more and more rich business, richer and richer business applications with it.
I think there's also two interesting scenarios for us to think about. There's I have an existing application, let's say deployed on premises or running in my office on my laptop and so on. So how can I add more value to that by having a data service available in the sky? And you could think of attached services. Maybe backup could be an attached service. Maybe publishing data from your local machine to make it accessible broadly across the internet could be another scenario. There's a whole host of interesting things there. And then secondly, there's a whole class of applications that don't really exist today. They're not deployed on premises. They're actually being enabled by the set of services that are actually emerging in the cloud environment. So storage as a service being the first one, but there could be a lot of other interesting services around there. There's the so-called mashup applications where we're taking data and services from one particular deployment or particular site, gluing it together in an interesting way and adding additional value by composing multiple of those services together. So we've used Sitka SSDS as essentially an enabler for a lot of those things. Mm-hmm. And as we start to expose more of the rich data processing that we have in our backend, given that we have SQL Server technology, those applications are just going to get richer and richer and more powerful.
How do we control versioning as new features come online?
So we think of versioning in a couple of different ways. So our goal all along in building the service head has really been around simplicity. So when we think about somebody building an application and keeping it up and running, compatibility across those different service versions is our primary goal, right? So for example, if we have hundreds of thousands of applications actually running on our data service, we realistically can't schedule an outage for our service to go upgrade those things. Mm-hmm. So we have to think about how we version our protocols on our API in an upwardly compliant way. Now, that's not to say that we won't make changes. So as our service actually emerges through our beta phase right now, the people will see changes in our data API. If we decide based on customer feedback that we've built something the wrong way or the shape of the service needs to change, we will break applications on purpose, right? Now, after our service actually goes live, the bar gets even higher for us. So we do have mechanisms that we've considered as to how we could actually build different versions of our service head and then over time deprecate older shapes of the service head. So for example, you build an app on V1 of our service, mm-hmm. possibly we deploy new capabilities on V2, and we support that V1 head for some period of time.
Right.
How long that would be? Probably more than months, but it certainly wouldn't be years.
I see. So from an addressing scheme, we're going to be able to put, like, I want to target V1 of the API versus V2 of the API,
yep.
that has newer features, and allow clients that maybe haven't updated their capabilities to still work with the older version for,
yep.
some period of time with us, so that we don't break them.
Exactly. So if you look at the anatomy of a basic URI, so our REST head,
mm-hmm.
so we have our scheme. So we support SSL and non-SSL today. You address what we call an authority, .data.zitka.microsoft.com/, then you have a version, sorry, my writing's pretty big here, v1/container ID/entity ID. So if you notice this piece here, this is essentially saying, I want to talk to this specific version of our service head.
Mm-hmm.
So if we decided to make breaking changes to our service head, And we felt it very important, say, to support these down-level versions here. We might deploy another URI, so we might have V2. And this would basically, this new V2 would give us the new semantics that we were looking for. And eventually we would drop support for this. So this gives a way to roll out new capabilities without really worrying about breaking applications.
Mm-hmm. The other place where we can extend the service easily is we do have a query language which you submit to the service for querying the entities in our service. It's easy to see how you could evolve that query language in the future. And you add more and more capabilities as we open up, as we discuss the SQL Server capability in the service. So that's one easy way to extend the service capabilities.
I see. I know developers and architects have been hearing about this idea when we talk about cloud-based services and storage in particular, about consistency. So there's some things called eventual consistency, guaranteed consistency. Why don't you elaborate for the folks listening, like, what does SSDS do for consistency and what's important about that?
SSDS is actually, we felt it's very important to provide some level of consistency. And this is not, it's really actually for the developer sake. It is easy to say, well, we shouldn't have consistency because then it's more scalable and we should push that all to the application developer. We felt strongly, coming from a database background, of course, also, consistency is actually is important, and it actually makes the developer's life much, much easier. You don't, when you do an action, you don't have to worry about, oh, well, maybe it only went half through, and I need to make sure I can compensate. Now, having said that, we actually did compromise in the service in the sense that inside, when you're inside of a container, you actually get full transactional consistency. So when you do operations against a container, you create entities, delete entities, you get transactional consistency. Across containers, we said, we don't support that yet. So if you do operations across two containers, we are not giving you a distributed transactional functionality. Each action against each container will be atomic and consistent, but we don't provide yet cross-container consistency. So actually, I actually think you get kind of best of both worlds, where it really matters in terms of scalability. You actually can distribute work across containers, and we don't force you to buy into a distributed transactional capabilities. Inside the container, though, you do get it. And so it's a very interesting world. You can scale out. You can create as many containers as you want. Containers can be fairly large. And inside that, you can do database-like operations, actually. So it's kind of interesting.
That's great. So, again, when I'm designing a new application, is SSDS targeted to existing applications, or is this targeted really to new applications? Or do you see, or is that just an arbitrary difference that I'm picking here?
Well, we think you can develop applications kind of the traditional way. For example, the two-tier, where it's very simple to see you can develop applications running two-tier against Sitka. But we really want to extend the market, so this is one of our main goals, is to actually enable new kind of scenarios. As Nigel already said, as we enrich the platform, more and more the traditional way of developing applications will be available as well. So I think it's really a combination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we've shown some of our examples. One of the examples I gave during my MIX talk was the Libware HR, which was a multi-tenant HR recruiting application. And that was essentially a classic ASP.NET app. And we demonstrated how we took essentially an app that was built for SQL Server or an arbitrary relational provider today, how that could be seamlessly retargeted over Sitka, mm-hmm. where we have the entity model versus a relational model. So in many respects, it can suit the needs of existing apps, but we also see it actually suiting the needs of these new emerging applications too.
Right. If I have a lot of investment, though, built into, say, stored procedures or mm-hmm. into a traditional relational yep. database or what it is, do you see short-term, long-term, or medium-term and long-term, where do you see SSDS fitting into that? I have these capabilities today in my backend, stored yep. procedures, very rich data querying languages, yep. maybe using a lot of the T-SQL mm-hmm. functionality. It sounds like right now that's not a good fit for SSDS, but let's talk about where that's going to go and how that fits.
So that's right. So in some sense, our first goal, our first wave of functionality, the thing we said is most important is let's just get a very, very basic data storage service that gives you basic query capabilities. because we have to bootstrap the service, get the whole ecosystem actually up and running, and then actually start to build that relationship with our potential customers, understand what people want, what's important for them, and so on. But at the same time, we also recognize we do have that SQL technology in the back end. So as you mentioned, we don't have stored procedures, we don't have hostable code, hostable business logic, and so on. But those are capabilities that we do see actually emerging through our platform. Now, would they emerge in the same way that as they exist today inside of SQL Server with T-SQL scripting language and so on? We're not really sure yet. So we've thought about computation, if you will, the ability to host code and business logic in our service head. And we think about big compute and little compute. So big compute, you could think of as being, hey, I want a VM in the cloud, and that virtual machine, I can run anything I want, and it's close to the data, so I have very, very low latency. And at the other end of the spectrum, we've got little compute, which is where I probably want little methods and little pieces of code that can also run close to my data. So I think the more likely thing that we would do first is offer some form of little compute, so the ability to host simple business logic, operations over entities that are close to the data, with a possibility of supporting bigger compute later.
Yeah, it's one way to look at it is how databases evolved also, right? First, we added, let's say, triggers to make sure that you can react to data changes. So this is one easy way to think about it. You put in data into Sitka, you will be able to write a trigger, if you will, to act on the data.
Yeah.
And then later, as Nigel said, then more and more logic. If you look at the kind of the rough layering of the system, right, we have the middle tier here, which is, of course, the users talk to. The middle tier then talks to the back end. And inside the back end, we actually have this other tier I'm going to call it, which is our manageability failover layer, which is watching that everything is going well. We actually could run logic in actually either of these places eventually. You could add some logic to our mid tier, or later maybe even add triggers or manage logic actually in both sides of these both places. We'll see how as we go. And as Nigel said, it might not be the exact same way, but you will get the same kind of functionality to triggers, workflows, acting on your data changes. So you can add logic.
Great. So today, SSDS is exposed via HTTP. We have SOAP and we have REST API to get to that. Just talk a little bit about what does that entail? Why did we choose that, for instance, and are we offering a TCP later? And maybe how that service was built.
So our main goal when we looked at Sitka and exposing the capabilities was first to make it as broadly accessible as possible. And because of that, we said there's a lot of people in the community that favor REST. There's also a number of people that favor SOAP. And we don't want that choice to be a barrier for entry to the service. So we said, let's do both, right? When we looked at how we could actually build out our service and do it in a nicely factored way, we chose WCF. So our web services tier that we have today, so if we take our little, I'm going to redraw it. That's just a little pair. So we have what you could think of as being our SQL tier. We have our management tier. And then we have largely what you might think of as being our web services tier. This web services tier is actually broken up into multiple heads. So we have our REST head, and we have our SOAP head. Right? And these guys are all using a single WCF implementation. So regardless of which protocol is actually coming in, they actually all get normalized into a bunch of interactions into a layer that we call the ACE layer. So ACE stands for Authority, Container, Entity, which are essentially the three components of our simple storage model. So this runtime layer is totally agnostic as to whether you come in over REST or SOAP. Now, in terms of supporting other protocols over time, that's really a decision that's going to be based on the feedback that we get from the community. So an example might be using WCF. For example, we could use a WCF binary protocol rather than textual protocol. And there's a bunch of performance benefits that you can actually get from that. The downside of that is it you have to have essentially version-compliant client and service heads. So that might actually be a barrier to adoption, a reason that we might not choose to do that particular approach. Now, in terms of serialization formats, and SOAP, it's given, it's dictated for you and so on. In terms of REST, today we support a simple XML format, so plain old XML, POX format is what we call it. Moving forward, there's a bunch of other interesting formats that we might actually consider. So JSON's one of them. Another one is APP, so the Atom Publishing Protocol. APP is actually interesting because as a company, we've made a decision to essentially align a lot of our services and our service technologies around using APP. Mm-hmm. So, of course, there's the Astoria code base itself, so the Microsoft Data Services Framework.
It's the ADO.NET Data Services.
Yeah, sorry, thank you. Seems to keep changing a little bit. But the thing about Astoria is they have a whole client-side ecosystem that speaks to essentially APP service heads. So we obviously don't have a developer tooling story today with Sitka, and there could be some advantages of us actually speaking APP because that opens up the whole Astoria ecosystem.
Right.
Now, would we just exclusively do APP? I don't think so. I think there's a lot of other different protocols that we might actually think of. So, for example, we might ultimately support a DAV head, DAV being very interesting, particularly when we start to think about blob storage in our service.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we only support simple structured entities, but blobs is probably the most asked for feature as we've talked to the,
right.
to the community.
Yeah, so one way to think about it is this is kind of like REST versus SOAP, but logically we could overlay, as kind of Nigel said, that maybe we have DAV here and then we have APP here.
Yeah.
And possibly other protocols later as we add, as you know, as the demand shows us that we need to add more different protocols, we'll support multiple heads. It's very easy to add different behavior on top of our mid-tier and just surface the data in multiple ways.
Right. I think probably for people that are just hearing about SQL Server Data Services, the name SQL Server just immediately conjures images of rows and columns and you know, these kind of entities. And you said something very interesting. You said the ACE layer, which was authority, container, entity.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth some time if maybe you spent and explained exactly what the ACE layer was and what that meant to an architect thinking about how they're going to map what they traditionally see as tables and databases and rows and columns into the ACE layer.
Well, there are multiple, there are actually two things here. One is what the ACE layer gives you is the hierarchical way of thinking about authorities on the top, and authorities can have containers, multiple containers underneath, and containers have what we entities underneath. And this is where actually again we can tie into the ADO.NET data services. There is a reason why we call these entities. Right now these entities are very flexible, simple, easy to use. They are practically like a property bag of name value pairs. But eventually you could think about it, and if I want to draw a loose analogy, you could think about this authority is almost like, you could think of it as almost like a SQL Server instance, if you will. In terms of, let me just make it a little bit. So the analogy here is that this is SQL Server, a server instance running, you could almost say loosely. Of course, it's not exactly the same thing. And you could think of the container, again, loosely as a database, which contains your tables and rows in the case of SQL Server, and here it contains entities. And entities, you actually already today, you can group them into multiple kinds, we call them kinds. You can have customers and orders here already today. We just don't enforce schemas yet, but eventually, as we evolve the service, we'll allow you to actually organize your data into schemas. I don't think we will ever lose the flexibility. We don't want to lose that. We want to make sure that this service is very approachable and very easy to use, very easy to add data, retrieve data, query data. Everything is indexed today. And this is the other thing is what we wanted to make sure, as Nigel already mentioned, is we want to make sure it's easy to get in there. You don't have to worry about setting up schemas, setting up indexes today. But eventually, you should be able to do that, and we'll get there.
That's interesting.
Nigel, if you have anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have asked us, hey, you know, where's the schema? Why did you start with flexibility? And there's a lot of different reasons, but the one of the reasons that that really resonates with me is that I've worked on relational systems for a long time. I'm an old data head. And one of the things that I've seen time and time again through our APIs is if you don't think about flexibility from the beginning, it's very hard to add flexibility into essentially a rigid API. So we went to the other end and said, well, let's start with flexibility because there's other benefits from that anyway. Mm-hmm. And then we can start to think about adding more square shaping, if you will, or tabular shapes over these flexible entities later. But if you don't think about the flexibility to start with, you're not likely to get it right or do it in a seamless way with the existing API. Now, it remains to be proven whether we can evolve our flexible API into a fairly rigid API and make it work from the other end. But we've tried it the other way, so we're trying it from flexibility first to rigid schema second.
Well, you showed an interesting capability in your mix talk, if I remember. That was you took what was an Access database, which mm-hmm. obviously is a fairly well-understood mm-hmm. schema,
yep.
And you actually synchronize that out to the cloud using the Microsoft Sync framework.
That's right. Yep.
So there are ways of working with between rigid data and flexible data.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that demo was essentially a vCard demo where we mm-hmm. took contact information stored in various data sources. The two data sources I demonstrated were essentially an Access database, which had a rigid schema table for contact information, and a vCard file provider. Now, there are other providers that we have that I didn't show. For example, I could have shown synchronizing between Outlook, synchronizing between Windows Live Contacts, and so on. Mm-hmm. But that is an example of where we took essentially rigid schema and mapped it into a flexible property bag, and we used that as a publishing hub and a hub-and-spoke synchronization topology.
Mm-hmm. I would like to kind of compare this to the XML world, where it's very similar, as Nigel said. It's you can actually map anything into XML. XML is a very flexible, easy to use format. It actually was designed partially to be a document format, data interchange format for this reason. You can describe anything with XML if you really want to. But if you go other way around, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to take an arbitrary XML schema or instance and map it to objects or tables or very mm-hmm. strict structure. So we kind of did a similar thing here. We are flexible. We can put a lot of different data types, data shapes into Sitka, and eventually we'll constrain it. And usually constraint means two things. It makes validation easier, so you can make sure that when you put in data, you know what the shape is. So that's one reason you may want to use a schema. And the reason is optimizations, of course. Now the store knows more about the shape, so the store can actually enforce and it can optimize better for layout and indexing and statistics and all these things. So there are good reasons why you want to be when you have schemas, but it doesn't necessarily mean you always want to have them.
Where do you see SSDS evolving in the long run? Is it going to eventually be SQL in the sky, SQL Server in the sky, or is it always going to retain some of these flexible capabilities and be maybe unrecognizable to someone familiar today with SQL?
Well, I think we'll always retain some of the flexibility, but even SQL Server today has a lot of the flexibility. We have XML support, we have file stream support, we have unstructured data support in SQL too. So the way I think about it is, you want these kind of capabilities whatever device you are in, whether it's a mobile device, whether it's in a cloud or in your desktop or in the enterprise. So SQL Server kind of goes through this spectrum. It actually provides a solution across all this spectrum today, even in the enterprise. In the cloud, part of the challenge for us is, as we said already, we want to make sure it's approachable, easy to use, and it's internet friendly, and it can be accessible from all kinds of platforms. Mm-hmm. So that makes some of these choices why we made these choices. We can't just simply take, okay, we'll take a TDS protocol and you throw TDS to an internet endpoint. But we'll have the SQL signature there. You will see all the capabilities SQL Server can do, not necessarily exactly the same way as SQL Server does it today.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's worth mentioning here is that over the past 3 or 4 years, there's been a big investment made in the SQL space in something called the entity data model. So essentially we've got the regular relational data model, and then we have a higher level model built on top of that. We think about modeling complex entities like customers, purchase orders, contacts, and things like that. And there's a whole set of tooling, schema design work, and so on that's going on out of the SQL Server division to actually make those things approachable and easy for people to use. So that's the ADO.NET V3, ADO.NET entities work. So for those of you who are familiar with the ADO.NET Data Services Framework, that is essentially using the EDM data model to essentially take something that is expressible in EDM terms and make it accessible using open internet protocols. So as we evolve our service around our notion of what we call flexible entities, those are the same entities that are in the EDM. Mm-hmm. EDM today doesn't really speak very much to flexibility and open content, property bags, if you will, but we've been working with the EDM architects as to how that can be extended and accommodated with the same set of schema design tools and APIs and protocols. So when we think about, as Isfan mentioned, schemas in the SSDS service head, they're essentially going to be EDM schemas and EDM types and EDM relationships and so on.
Okay, so as an architect, now I kind of have an understanding of, loosely speaking, of the ACE concept. I know I'm going to have HTTP protocol support. I'm going to have some latency, obviously, today until we get what you call that little compute, at least, capabilities. Talk to me about security. This is the next thing. How am I securing the data? Confidentiality. Run for some of the folks watching this. What are our thoughts about the security and what we're going to do and some of the capabilities that we're at least looking into? Mm-hmm.
So the security model that we've basically shared with people so far that will be part of our beta is relatively simple. So a single principal, so a single user signs up for an account, and that account can then provision one or more authorities. And then, as Isfan mentioned, authorities can have containers and container store entities. Essentially, all of the data that you have stored beneath a single authority and all of its containers are secured to that single user account. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about authorization and access to the service, when you actually send your request to the service, you provide your user ID, almost think about it as being an application ID, mm-hmm. and the secret password that was provisioned for you. We validate that you are indeed the owner of that specific authority or the container that you're accessing, and if so, you get what you might think of as being full control. Now, that's a fairly limited model, right? So it actually speaks fairly well to essentially N-tier deployments where an application owns all of the data, mm-hmm. but it doesn't really address the notion of different principals having different roles over the same data. Mm-hmm. For example, I have an owner role on this container. I have a writer role, I have a reader role, and so on. Mm-hmm. So when we look at actually extending that, we think about adding those roles to containers. So for those of you familiar with the NT-ACL model, an ACL is essentially an access control list. An access control list has a set of ACEs, access control elements, and each individual ACE lists essentially an owner or a SIT, a principal, so it might say Ryan or Nigel, and then it lists a specific set of rights for that principal, full control, read access, write access, and so on. So we're looking at, in some sense, extending our security model and allowing you to have different roles over, say, the authority level and the individual container level. So ultimately, you could enable scenarios where Nigel has full control over a container, but he offers both Istvan and Ryan read permission to the content inside of that container.
Will we have something like anonymous for those mashup scenarios?
That's actually interesting. So we talked quite a while ago about this notion of having public read content. That is, you can actually come in and you don't have to provide any credentials and it's actually authorized. That's something we could very easily turn on. It actually gets interesting when you think about the economic model. Essentially, we will be selling essentially Sitka as a service, right? So that in the sense of we're hosting your data and providing you storage and basic computation over it, we will charge you for the resources that you consume. Now, if you choose to enable one of your containers as public read access, mm-hmm. that means that anybody over the internet can start hammering that container. So while it's easy for us to give that feature, the question is, how would you feel about being billed when, say, a URI leaks and various people start hammering over that? So that's something that we have to look into in terms of the right way of dealing with this. For example, that might be a case where quotas might come in. Mm-hmm. Say, this is essentially this quota assigned to public access to this container. That container is only allowed to have so many operations in a certain time period or transfer so much information to provide safeguards for those scenarios.
So are there any streaming capabilities or anything like that today? Or how is the data coming out of SSDS?
So today, there's... the place where streaming really comes in today is really when I perform a query. So we do HTTP streaming. So if I do a query against a container, essentially right now we limit each result set to be no more than 500 records. Okay, so we have a simple paging pattern that people use. Now, as part of the data coming back of that 500 record result set, that data is actually streaming over the regular HTTP channel. Mm-hmm. So for structured data, you get streaming no matter what. Now, as we've started to look at how we might enable blob support or blob entities, streaming is really, really important there, because you could think of an individual blob instance being megabytes, if not gigabytes, in size. People have this canonical scenario: I want to rip all my home movies and actually store them in inside of SSDs, right? How can I efficiently access, a two gig ISO file? Right, so that speaks to both streaming, and it also speaks to random access patterns. Mm-hmm. The idea that we might essentially take that 2 gig and give you the ability to fire up multiple threads that read various portions of that. So you can think of download acceleration. We've got 10 threads going, and they're all reading different parts of the blob file. Mm-hmm. Now, how might we actually do that in a performant way in our service head? What we would do is we take that 2 gig blob file, and we would break it into chunks, let's say 2, 4, 8 megabytes in size, and then we would distribute those chunks across our backend cluster of SQL Server nodes, mm-hmm. so that when each of your individual read requests comes in, we can go look at which set of chunks you actually need to retrieve, and then we'd fire off those requests to the backend servers, and that would give you fairly efficient read throughput through our service head.
That's great. One last question. We talked a little bit about geolocation at one point when we were building up the service, and it kind of boils down to the authority at some level. Where do we see geolocation going, and what are our plans around geolocation?
Well, as you said today, the authority is kind of your way of geo-placing your data. We didn't talk about it here, but each authority can live in a different place on Earth, in a different data center, a different continent. The containers in a given authority will live in one data center, so you actually have some control over your physical layout of your data this way. Right now, we don't give you the option yet to place an authority, let's say in Europe, but it's coming, so you will be able to place authorities in different places. We are also thinking about geo-replication and geo-backup and geo-failover, meaning you should be able to say, well, this authority should be replicated into this other authority in another place to make sure I have availability in both places if something happens in another place. Or the other interesting scenario is data is close to you. So you can make sure that if you have a lot of customers in Europe, for example, you can place part of your data and replicate it to make sure it's also available in case something happens. Mm-hmm. And so for business continuity reasons, you may want to make sure that your data lives in two places. Of course, it's going to cost you a little bit more because you have more copies of that data, so it's not free. But we are definitely thinking of how to enable these kind of geo scenarios in the future.
So, when we look about the geo scenarios, will we have to pick a specific data center essentially, or are we thinking about dynamically figuring out where to send a user to based on their IP address?
Well, we'll still need to figure that out, how it's going to work, because you may want to have both things. You may want to make sure that the data kind of migrates as you use it to make sure it kind of stays close to you. But you also may want to actually put it in a specific location. So we don't know exactly how we exactly going to manage that, but both scenarios could be very interesting. Yeah.
So a bunch of the capabilities that Isfahan's mentioned, they're almost like add-on features, right? So I could think of, I go to SSDS, I get basic storage, the basic authority container model. Maybe in one billing scheme, I don't have any control which data center I choose from, right? Ultimately, when I create an authority, eventually we'd like to give people the option of where that data is stored. Now, if I want multiple redundant copies across data centers, that could be an add-on service that we actually provide. If I want geo backup capabilities, that is, I want my data to be essentially backed up to another remote data center, again, that's an add-on service. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we've heard from our customers is this notion of differentiated SLA, so service level agreement. Part of that goes to differentiate capabilities and so on. So as we've been looking about how we might extend our service head, one of the things that we've been trying to pay particular attention to is, how can we actually support those different billing models to our customers? Because one of the things that really comes through is cost. People care a lot about cost. Right? Mm-hmm. They want this thing to be cost effective.
Right?
And that really comes down to, I want to pay for the services I use. So for example, if I don't need Geo Backup or Geo REPL, I don't care which data center my data is in, I don't want to have to pay anything special for that. Right?
Okay, that makes sense. Well, that's great, guys. You said that we have a beta program spinning up, which and the public beta has 1,500 signups?
About 1,600
signups.
Right now.
That's great. Why don't you write up on the board for folks that are interested in pre-registering for that beta, where they can go to sign up? It's Microsoft.com.
I think I have a space here. / SQL / data services. And there's a sign up link there for the beta.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, gentlemen. This has been fascinating. I appreciate your time.
Yep.
And I'm sure the folks watching do
great.
As well.
Great. Sign up and use the service.
Thank you.